Welcome to Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. Challenging debate on the state of education today. Thanks for listening. Kevin Chavis was an NCAA District All-American in basketball while playing for Wabash College in Indiana. If there were such a thing, Kevin will be an All-American in providing quality education for underserved kids who are trapped in failing schools. A noted author, attorney, national education leader, Kevin is also a former member of the Council of the District of Columbia. As chair of the Council's Education Committee, Kevin was at the forefront of promoting change within the district public school system, and he helped to shepherd the charter school movement into the nation's capital. He's now president of academics, policies, and schools for K-12 Inc., a technology-based education company and leading provider of curriculum and online school programs for students pre-K through high school. His battle to rescue school kids who are stuck in the educational prisons of failing schools is well known by many. It's a pleasure to welcome you, Kevin, into my podcast today.
Well, thank you. You missed one thing. I'm a friend of Jeannie Allen, so that really matters. That's in the resume.
You are a friend, a longtime friend, and I am so grateful for that and for your participation here today in so many forums as a member of CER's Board of Directors.
And it's very exciting work, Jeannie. I admire you so much because you've been a model for me in terms of stick-to-itiveness. A lot of people have what I will call, and I'm not being critical, just being factual, drive-by experiences in terms of this education reform issue, and you have been committed throughout, and I have tried to follow your lead. This is my life's work, it's your life's work, and frankly, I think it needs to be a better priority for people in this country.
You know, I couldn't agree more, Kevin. It is amazing whenever you pick up the papers, and I don't care what your flavor is or what you believe or who you back, but the fact that education isn't covered as much in the press, that we kind of put it aside as one of our primary issues, I don't get it. What do you think?
Well, it's amazing to me because so much is tied to an education. When I got involved in this issue when I was on the D.C. Council, and I realized that everything that ends up being leads to being a productive citizen is directly tied to your educational opportunities. I mean, if you don't have the skills, if you don't have the education, you're not going to get a good job. You're not going to be a contributing member of society, and you won't have a productive life. You end up, in many ways, being dependent on the society and government to get by. And I realized that when all the, you know, from drug abuse to challenge in terms of a job market, all these things are more accented when you aren't educated. And yet and still today, the irony is that while we talk about some of these, social and economic issues that plague our country, the only way to deal with them effectively is for us to make sure that we have an educated population. As you know, I talk about Thomas Jefferson and his view that the biggest thing, the biggest threat to democracy is not a foreign power, but an uneducated population. And you can see that, and I just don't think people have made a connection. And the other thing I'll say is people have this sort of parochial, nostalgic view of their image of education, which is locked into, you know, walking to the neighborhood school and getting lockers and going to a prom. They don't realize that the dynamism associated with what's possible in education extends beyond a time and a place, that education is a constant, lifelong endeavor. But people are now, because of this, sentimentality, they view it as something that you go to as opposed to something you experience as a way of being. And I think that has contributed to the fact that it's not front and center. And the last thing, Jeannie, is it's hard. So if you're a politician, if you're a policymaker, you know how tough it is to change, you know, the traditional approach to education. And you're looking for easy fixes, soundbite stuff that can get you votes or support. And the hard stuff isn't something that is going to help your political career. And I think for those reasons, you don't see our leaders talk about it. And frankly, I think those of us who believe passionately in the right of all kids to get a quality education, we've got to continue to carry that message.
Amen. And, you know, you say it's hard. And I just want to point out again to folks that you were a city councilman. You were or are a lawyer. You're kind of a recovering lawyer now. You were president of your graduating class from Howard University School of Law. That's pretty hard. And yet you've chosen to work in and around making education a possibility for more people on the outside.
I did because, I don't know, it was my work. You know, I was drawn to it. I feel like it was my own manifest destiny, if you will. When I ran for office back in 92, 93, I was not looking to get involved in education. But when I visited our prisons and I visited our schools and I saw that direct bad school to prison pipeline, and also got to know some of the young men in particular and saw they had this potential. Some of them were really decent human beings, but they did not get the education that they were entitled to. And some of our schools weren't serving them well. It was like a light switch, Jeannie, and my life changed. So it is hard work, but there's nothing more rewarding than seeing kids who have been otherwise unengaged or written off get their education and get stimulated by learning and be successful. I can tell you, in this role of K-12, you know, I spoke at nearly 10 graduations, and to see some of these kids who have been bullied with physical challenges and medical challenges and, you know, the kids who are in special needs, and to see them, you know, walk across that stage, it's inspiring, and that's what motivates me. So, I mean, like you, I'm all in. I'm going to continue to, blast that trumpet. And I know people are listening. We just got to make sure we blast it as far and as wide as we can.
Yes, we do. And we have to keep connecting these dots. You know, I've had on the show Governor Tommy Thompson, who, like you, will be working with us and celebrating at CER's 25th Anniversary Summit on October 26th. And he, in his own right, did extraordinary things crossing the aisle and working to create and advance choices. He's saying what you're saying. He's going, look, we have people in prison. We should be creating schools for them. So the minute they get out, they're trained and ready to go. We need to be connecting the dots. You know, he was HHS secretary under George W. Bush. He's been in the healthcare field since he left there. And he's saying whether it's health, education, workforce, they're all connected. You cannot be healthy unless you're well educated. You cannot be well employed unless you are well educated, trained, and have a relevant work environment. And so these are the things that we have to be bringing together. You've, of course, talked about these in Building a Learning Culture in America, one of your three books. That's extraordinary. And hope you'll bring those books also and sign them at our event coming up. But Kevin, I know that you are you're trying to grapple with this too at K-12. So I want to get back to your kind of political thoughts and stuff like that. But let's turn to K-12 because you're trying to reach a lot of different people than when K-12 started out. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, K-12 started as a curriculum company that was tailored toward the homeschool crowd, a way of using technology and the state-of-the-art curriculum to help parents who wanted to educate their children at home. And it sort of morphed into a teaching and learning company. We're in 36 states. We've got nearly 120,000 students in our managed public schools, where we have contractual relationships with folks in certain states who have charters. They've been authorized to run a virtual charter school, and we provide the teaching, that we provide the professional development, we provide the curriculum. And we also have relationships with school districts where we do the same thing. So of those 120,000 students, I think that that would make us a top 20, top 25 school district. And we probably are more representative of America than most school districts because we have the rural kids, the urban kids, the talented and gifted, the special needs, the bullied kids, medical challenges. You know, we've got the whole gamut. And it also means we have, we have to be diverse in terms of our approach. So the challenge that I have embraced wholeheartedly is making sure that we do something, Jeannie, you've been talking about for years, as opposed to above the line, below the line ways to measure these kids. It's all about growth. If a kid comes to us, I've told our folks, I don't care if they're at negative 17 in terms of the scales of proficiency, then we want to improve them, and we want to get them to negative 12, negative 5, plus 1, plus 10 proficient. Growth for these kids is going to differ, if especially a kid who's autistic or a kid who's dyslexic. We have to make sure that we have student-centered approach to accountability that works for these kids, and that's something that I'm focused on. And I tell you that all kids can learn, and all kids will learn if they're inspired to learn. So we're not only dealing with understanding where they need to be to get to where they should be, we also, and this is critically important, we want to make sure they're engaged. Jeannie, you're a big advocate for school choice. So many of our kids have been to two or three different schools before they come to us. Our Arizona 12th graders, most of them were first-time K-12 enrollees, so they've been to several schools. And when you talk about school choice, 65% of our first-time K-12 students have no other form of school choice in their area.
Wow.
It's the brick-and-mortar school that they can go to that doesn't work for them, or there is us.
So it's a traditional school or coming to you. And they've not succeeded. And so they've not succeeded there. And like so many people who move, right, they're not successful in one place, so they want to move.
That's right. And so if you think 65% of our new enrollees have no other form of choice, no charter school, no magnet school, no specialty school. So, you know, one of the things we do, we recognize we have to do better academically, but we also want to engage these kids to keep them where they need to be, because if they stay with us 3 years, we know we can get them, you know, over 14, 15 points progress in math and in reading, and they'll be engaged. But to get them engaged, get them excited, and keep them in our program is our ultimate goal, particularly since so many of these kids are behind. The last statistic I shared, Jeannie, just so people know,
that
the proficiency rating, the kids who are proficient, first-time K-12 enrollees, only 11%. So that means 89% of the kids who enroll in our schools are not at grade level. And that is something that we grapple with, but I know, and we have example, and we have data that shows we can turn this around, but the whole country needs to wake up to the fact that a lot of kids aren't getting where they deserve, and that's the value of school choice.
Right, and many of those students are being passed from place to place. Their parents often don't, as you said, either have another option, they're not aware of options. We used to have more and more options increasing every year. As you well know, charter school growth has been stalling over the last few years as a lot of well-intentioned but flawed thinking around regulating choices has become kind of vogue, right? And then there's this whole thing, which I find fascinating, Kevin. I'm sure it just drives you guys crazy, that there are some people out there that just go, oh, online schools can't work for kids. I mean, we have to have them in front of someone. So in other words, you want to be in front of a flawed system or a school that doesn't fit them rather than having them tailored or personalized?
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, you know, online education is the centerpiece of personalized learning, which everyone says they want. And if they feel like the online space doesn't have value in education, then, you know, take those iPads or those smartphones away from your kids.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what these kids, I'm on planes all the time, Jeannie, you see this, and you see 4, 5, and 6-year-old kids with their iPads and their smartphones, and now parents use them as babysitters too, but the reality is that's how kids are learning. And we really need to, if we're going to meet kids where they are, one of the things that we're real excited about is we use, you know, this form of gamification to get kids excited, engaged. We the reward system, badges and coins, peer-to-peer interaction in our Class Connect sessions. It stimulates the learning process as opposed to some of our traditional systems where kids are forced to sit in a classroom, be still, don't move, listen to a lecture for 40 minutes, regurgitate it back 2 weeks after that, and then forget it a month later. Now, project-based learning, personalized learning, experiential learning, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, getting kids involved in the learning process by doing, those are all things that we're we're doing in the virtual space. And in terms of skill development, we're real excited about our new push towards CTE so that we can get kids who want to develop a career certification or licensure in healthcare or in IT or business. And we can get, as opposed to 30 kids maneuvering around to a site in traffic,
right,
we can get 100, 200 kids in one place, and also through virtual reality, have them develop the skills that, so they don't even have to go to the job to get the certification. And that's what we're, one of the things we're excited about around the country.
Well, and you know, you just pointed out something too. You have the time it takes to get to places. So no, online is not for everyone. Virtual blended is different. The key is, if you're in a position where you're not getting what you need, this could be time saving, right? I mean, the fact that you don't have to shift and move in hallways, that you don't have to deal with some of the requirements of the school day that maybe, you know, you're not interested in. It's fascinating to me because we do, in fact, embrace technology, transfer of learning through technology in so many other industries. But again, K-12 was like, I think, our last remaining 1850s era, right, institution that we just have a hard time breaking our mindset around.
Yeah, it's true. And Jeannie, you know, I know we steered away from it, but I have to bring us back because, and you've heard me use this expression a lot, you know, one of the biggest challenges in terms of K-12 reform is, yes, hard work, and yeah, there's some nostalgia associated with it, but the politics of education has been so toxic, and I say all the time, there's
That's
no
right.
Republican or Democratic way to teach a kid how to read, write, or count, and yet we have layered the politics of education on top of education policy, so it isn't what's best for kids. It really is what the political order of the day and the label associated with the proposal. And that has been a big challenge.
Well, it's interesting because you know this, but it's no matter who I talk to, whether it's on the Hill or in state legislatures, doesn't matter their party, they always quote a constituency that is not a parent. Right. Even those who might support and embrace education transformation of the kind we talk about writ large, that we talk about on this show, Kevin Chavis, there, it's just stunning to me. I was on the Hill recently, and there was a senior level legislative staffer who said, "Now, so what are we going to say when the school boards walk in here and say X, Y, and Z?" And I thought, why do you care? I mean, I'm actually telling you some things that are working for kids, and you're asking me, what are they going to say? It's still stifling to think that. And that's why sometimes building consensus on these things is not the way to go. You just have to get it done.
Well, and you know, Jeannie, again, I know this is a Jeannie Allen show, but I'm telling you, but you embody this more than anyone. We have to respect the end user. And the end user are the parents and the families. You've always talked about parental engagement and parental empowerment. And that is key. I think that when you talk about education policy, it becomes sort of a circular conversation among the, folks who aren't necessarily the end users, you know, the educated elite. And we need to make sure that we continue to tailor the conversation to the parents and the kids who would benefit from other options, because they're the ones who, once they're empowered, they're going to want more of it. But I think sometimes we lose our focus. And so you're right. I mean, building consensus is a great, you know, goal. But the best way to build consensus is to showcase what's possible to these families and have them start to fight for it.
And so here's a reality check for you. What is it that got you engaged as a Democrat on the city council? Why did you actually stop to question and not just take constituencies for granted?
Well, because I got to meet the people. And, it's one thing to see numbers on a page, but when I visited the Lorton prison at the time and I spent time with these young men, first I went to the prison, I'll be honest, and I spent some time with these young men, and I thought, okay, these are going to be, you know, criminals or
whatever.
Wait, what
you thought you were going to get votes, didn't you?
You wouldn't have known. No, I did not. But I'm almost ashamed to say I didn't see the humanity. And I went in with the impression of these, you know, folks selling drugs and murders, whatever. But when I talked to them and I heard, you know, some of the stories, and some of the kids, some of the young men in the institution were came from families where there were challenges, and one or two would say, oh, you know, I was good in math, but, you know, my math teacher said I'd never amount to anything. And I said, wow, there seemed to be a pattern. Then when I visited our schools and I saw how in word and deed the low expectations was placed on certain kids based on their neighborhoods, it just changed everything. And at the time we were considering the charter school legislation, I fought to take over the chairmanship of the Education Committee. And I said to the union, I said, look, I'm going to support charter schools, but I'll give you the money you want. And after 3 years, you know, I gave them more money than they asked for, gave teachers more of a raise than they had asked for. And, you know, the outputs in DCPS, DC Public Schools, went down with more money. And they were educating 10,000 fewer students because many of them were leaving the city or going to the charter schools. And at the same time, the charter schools were doing markedly better. In fact, by the time I left, the charter schools were doing 20 points higher than DCPS, even though DCPS had been getting more money. And it struck me that, look, you know, we're saving lives by investing in children as opposed to investing in systems. I know that's blasphemy to some people, but I think that as opposed to being system-focused, we need to be focus on individual children. And I, as I said, I just feel like that it became my calling when I saw the disparities, and particularly the lack of promise that was fulfilled or unfulfilled with these men and women who, but for accident of birth, didn't get a chance to meet their full potential.
And you talked about the politics. I mean, you were able to get these things done because you challenged the traditional politics of it. I will point out to our listeners, you ran for mayor. You were incredibly well positioned for that. And then you told me stories, which is so true. And it's what makes America great. But, you know, people saying to you, like calling you during snowstorms and say, you're going to come plow my yard, and are you taking my garbage out? And the fact that citizens didn't really think about that legislators or mayors could do these major things is one of our big gaps, right?
Well, it is. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of our folks, particularly in challenged communities, there are a whole host of issues they deal with every day. And one of the big things is sort of like the I gotcha thing is, you know, what they're getting on the other side of town that I'm not getting. But everyone believes that. You know, if you live in Georgetown, you say, okay, well, most of the city services are going to go over to the other side of the city first and then vice versa. Mm-hmm. The reality is when it comes to education, most of our communities aren't getting what they deserve, you know?
Right.
So, but they don't, you know, the expression, they don't know what they don't know. And so part of what I realized when I was running for mayor and going around the city, that we were locked in an idea or a memory that maybe it was parents or grandparents' experience in education, you know, that historic high school that was the high-performing high school in the 40s and 50s, that was not that way in the 90s or 2000s, but it was an idea. It was an image, and because there was no other comparison until we had the charter school movement, people didn't know what was possible.
Right.
And now the one thing that the charter movement and choice movement has done, it has exploded the idea that all we need, all that works, is one size fits all.
And money, right? Then it was also money.
That's right. It's exploded all of that. And so I think that's been the value add. But to get to the next level, Jeannie, personalized learning in the purest sense, we've got to keep pushing the envelope. And we've got to insert technology into the equation. And we've got to make sure that those parents and families who benefit from it, that we give them a bigger voice and a platform.
Right. And those underserved people and our, you know, sort of communities of color. I mean, you were on the founding team of Black Alliance for Educational Options, Democrats for Education Reform. And yet so many of us struggle trying to figure out how does this message of, you know, public schools need to set kids on a lifetime of failure getting through the African-American community. In other words, those that aren't working for them, how do we help get this message through so that we can all help them begin to fight for rights?
Well, I do think, you know, one of the reasons why Bail had some success early on through Howard Fuller's leadership, but it was also through the focus that, you know, you have to have the right messengers with the message. And I think that, you know, right now we need to be more aggressive in terms of building relationships with trusted voices in these affected communities.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily, you know, you and I be the message carriers, but the folks that are trained. It's like the training the trainer thing. I know that when Bail was most effective in places like Philadelphia and Louisiana and Milwaukee, that what they would do is they would go into public housing communities or low-income communities, talk to the resident councils, engage them about what's possible, make sure that they talk to people, peers in other cities who experience the benefit of choice programs or charter schools that work, and then have them be the ones who carry the message to the community. I think that we've lost some of that. I think that with some of the push from many of our, you know, ed reform groups and even our foundation leadership, that we've put together cookie cutters approaches that aren't locally based or locally themed.
And ignoring the grassroots, yeah.
Yeah, ignoring the grassroots. And I think that because the grassroots stuff is hard, and that means you have to invest in putting time and energy and finding trusted voices in their community as opposed to, you know, importing folks or transporting, planting folks in. And I think that the way you engage folks in need is through the trusted voices in their communities. And I think that that's hard work that a lot of us don't want to do.
Yeah, well, you know, America is full of great stories from its inception of one person doing extraordinary things. I mean, it doesn't look, Hamilton is so common right now. When you think about Hamilton and Madison, and no matter who got along, they're in their 20s. They were like individuals. And, you know, 30 years ago, the housing barriers were broken through by individuals working to push their government. And so rank and file citizens do, in fact, make a huge difference. And we really do have to, and I value you because one of the other books you wrote was about sort of the individual people in the communities making things happen. It really is critical. So you've been an equal opportunity critic on politics and politicians over time. You stood strong, and when the DC School Choice Program that you helped create was risking closure, you challenged President Obama, who you had voted for. You challenged him publicly and said, I don't agree with you, and pushed him. What do you think about what's going on now? Tell me your reviews of Secretary DeVos on when it comes to education. What could we be doing more of? What would you say to her?
Well, you're right about President Obama. I was on his education policy committee when he ran the first time, and I was a supporter of his. I think that he did. I don't think he'll ever get full credit for what he did to promote charters at the time. It really made a huge difference. By the same token, the notion that money going to the same system won't make a difference is embodied in Race to the Top. I mean, Jimmy, we spent $7 billion, and I thought it was a great idea at the time. $7 billion were farmed out to different states in Race to the Top, and the results, as Arne Duncan said, were negligible. Mm-hmm. I mean, there, you know, if you look at the progress, then we're a picture of stagnation, and those are Arne Duncan's words. So I do think that what that told me, and I've talked a lot with Rod Page about this kind of thing, is that, you know, our expectations of what any education secretary can do, they have to be viewed in context. I think the biggest opportunity is to be a bully pulpit to promote things that would create what I would like to see, a more robust national obsession around learning, and also work with folks to be creative, to help foster innovation and creative thinking in schools. As you know, Betsy DeVos has been a great friend. I don't talk with her much anymore because, you know, the nature of her work. But I also think that what has happened is, you know, whatever she has tried to do, it's been caught up in the politics of the current president. And I think that President Trump, that the whole dynamic with his administration is the classic either or. I mean, either you're for him right. or you're against him. And I think that the sort of the divisive nature of some of the rhetoric that's come from, you know, the White House has even exacerbated that. So if I haven't talked with Betsy about it, but what I would urge, which is hard in this environment, it's hard for anybody, and I think in this administration, is she would have to try to figure out ways to rise above the voice in the White House, which is increasingly difficult, and try to engage in those kind of conversations that would promote innovation, creativity, forward-looking kind of policies, and support them. And when it comes to school choice, I think she's got to continue to support that and push that, but see what kind of alliances she can build with folks on the ground. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that 85 to 90% of all education funding is locally based.
Right.
So the department can only do so much, but I think the bully pulpit for creating a learning, what I call yeah. learning culture, is something that any and all Secretary of Education should be at the forefront of doing.
I love that. A national obsession around learning, Kevin. That's amazing. All right.
There are so many things you can do. Like, let me give you an mm-hmm. example. I said this to folks who work for the mayor of D.C. They said, well, you know, they're looking for a new superintendent. What are some things you can do that, if you're in these positions, that would resonate with people? Well, one way to create a national session around learning, the mayor of D.C. should say, I'm going to offer a third grade reading guarantee. Any kid that, you know, goes into a fourth grade in this city will be able to read. And I'm going to build the right strategic partnerships with business community. So if by second grade we find that, you know, Johnny, Jane, Jose, or Jamal can't read, then, you know, folks at the YMCA are going to help. Or folks at Intel are going to help. Mm-hmm. Or folks at AOL, and I think that the education secretary, whoever it is, and I think Betsy could do this, as opposed to being caught up in some of the nuances of the regulatory stuff, where there's going to be politics back and forth. There should be some time set aside for putting aspirational goals in learning and education for the country. So you know what? You know, we want to make sure that I'm going to work with states. If you do third grade reading guarantees, or you do graduation guarantees at your high school, mm-hmm. Or you do, if you move the needle on some of these proficiency things, two-thirds of our high school graduates are now proficient or college ready.
Mm-hmm.
If you promote CTE, I mean, I think there are things that you can package together so that you almost help depoliticize things in a way that the focus is on learning and not just whether or not you politically support one thing or another.
One program over another. I think that's such a great point. I mean, you know, it's sad to say. I mean, look, there's so many people doing so many great things that are listening. But, you know, I think about you playing, playing successfully at Wabash. I don't know if you ever thought about the NBA or not, but maybe had you been an athlete, people would be listening more. Like, it kills me that if you're Serena was all over the news because of what happened with her, you know, supposed misbehavior, which I thought she's awesome. But anyway, it's a whole other thing. But if you're an athlete, you get front page news no matter what.
Yeah, I want you to know, Jeannie, the older I get, the better I was. So I want you to know that I was amazing back then.
You were almost recruited.
Yeah, right. I was almost somebody.
Okay, final question. Any political runs in your future we should know about?
I am running for president in 2024. That's what my name is.
President of the learning culture, right?
President of these United States. When I heard Kanye was running, yeah. I said, oh, you know what? I got to put my hat in the ring.
All right. All right. Good. Shave us for 2024. You heard it here first on Reality Check, folks. I love it. We're going to take that one to the bank, getting the bumper stickers made. All right, Kevin Chavis, thank you so much. I am looking forward to being with you also in Miami, October 26th. Folks, if you enjoyed what you heard, you will hear lots more of it and can come wrestle with us, argue, disagree, agree, and join hands wherever you are on this, the most important thing we can be doing, which is making sure everyone is educated, learners at all levels. Thanks again, Kevin.
Much love, Jeannie. Thank you.
Listen and subscribe to Reality Check on edreform.com, National Review Online, iTunes, Stitcher, and everywhere podcasts are heard. Find out more at edreform.com/realitycheck.